It has been far too long since a 15-60 look at the Eastern Conference. Joining me to do that, Danny LaRue.
How you doing? Good to be a little bit rested for this one.
Yeah, it feels weird to be recording like during the morning since I have to travel later. But yeah, I don't know. I actually feel like more at my best late at night personally. But so that means the show's going to be terrible, obviously.
I'm concerned now.
Well, at least this intro was better than our last intro. That's the important part. Let's get to the Atlanta Hawks.
Yeah, so Atlanta, you know, they're in kind of a nebulous place, as with every team that you've said at some point was the second best team in the Eastern Conference.
yeah, just the curse of death, right?
They're 23-16, 2-3 since the last time we did this. And one stat that I thought was interesting is that in the last month, they forced the most turnovers in the league on 18.5% of possessions, which is not sustainable. Teams don't really get in that level. But what that shows is just kind of a wrinkle to their defense that can be really effective considering the transition resources they have when they can actually generate those kinds of opportunities.
Yeah, Kyle Korver is someone who really, really thrives in transition. We saw in the playoffs that when teams are really locked down on him, not in a regular season setting, but when they really are he's high on the scouting report, you've practiced it in the half court, it can be difficult for him to get shots in a full court situation matching up to him. Either guys are scrambling to get out to him, and that opens up driving lanes, or they can get him an open shot, which, because he's not really like that versatile of a guy, he works pretty hard, but he's just 34 years old and doesn't have a ton of athleticism, that really helps them. And Al Horford, another guy too, who will run the floor hard, can get some jumpers in transition or run right to the rim, partially perhaps because of the spacing that Korver provides.
Yeah, I was shocked to look that he's right now the season leader in transition points per possession. He has less possessions than the guys who are kind of in the higher usage thing, like Kevin Durant, who's first among guys with more than 100, but he's at 56, which is, you know, enough. And that was interesting. And also, I think you talked about it, that there was a nice play where they did an action for Korver in semi-transition, which is the other type of thing a smart team, especially a team with capable bigs, can do to free somebody like Korver.
Yeah, if they have their point guard bringing the ball down the right side of the floor, one of their secondary actions, like a secondary break, essentially is, you know, the primary is, all right, you're just going to run right to the rim, or we're just going to throw it to you right at the three-point line, and you're going to shoot it. But secondary is basically a little bit of structure that provides something for you to do when you come down in a semi-transition situation. And you'll see this three or four times a game, and they get guys with this all the time, where Korver will be on the left wing. They bring the ball down the right side, and then he will get a screen coming to the ball, either from Millsap or Horford generally, or maybe someone like Splitter. It's effective because whoever is guarding that guy, generally the big will have sloughed back to protect the paint. And so one thing that you can do when you have shooters is if your big is not being guarded, yeah, he can't shoot from out there, but he can go screen for a shooter knowing that there's not going to be any help. And Korver has the footwork to come right to the top of the key, make the catch, and he's much better moving to his right and catching and shooting. And so he'll get probably, you know, 2, 3, 4 shots a game, depending on the quality of the defense off of that action, and it's pretty deadly.
Yeah, I mean, and you're right. I think that better teams, when you get into the scouting situations, will be able, I think they'll even be able to take away a little bit of that, but it's harder to prevent than the half court stuff.
Well, so who should I give the kiss of death to this week, by the way?
No one.
As the second best team in the East.
No one.
I said Toronto, then I felt like the Bulls, when they won 6 straight, were starting to get there, then they immediately lost. They lost 3 in a row and looked horrible doing it. The Hawks, 2-3, when we were talking about maybe it could be them. Washington at the start of the year. I mean, who haven't we? Yeah, Boston, we said some good things about. They started to be terrible as well. Who haven't we said good things about? Maybe we'll anoint the Pacers. They can be the next one.
So Celtics fans asked us to say the Nets, but we will not.
Before we move on to the Celtics, I'm proud to tell you about a new sponsor of the podcast, Helix Sleep. The way I've been trying to get sponsors is taking products that I already use, going to them and basically saying I think I would be a great ambassador for their product. And Helix, I absolutely going to be that because my experience with them has been awesome. My girlfriend moved in with me this year and we needed a new mattress, a California King. She did some research and I'm about 6'6", 220. She is significantly smaller than that. So we're attracted to Helix because you can personalize the mattress based on a 2 to 3 minute questionnaire. You can either get one side for one person, one for the other, or you can get a blend, which is what we ended up getting, that was going to work for both of us. Then the mattress is made to order for you. It ships in a box that's the size of some golf clubs. You can open it up and just put it on your bed. It arrives in 7 to 10 business days. And if for some strange reason you don't like it, you can have free, no-hassle returns for up to 100 days. We, however, have slept amazingly well since we got it. The pricing is fantastic. They start at only $600. They go up to about $1,000 for the California King that we got. And now my listeners can use the code CAPSPACE for $50 off on your purchase. That lets them know that you came from us, and also gets to your $50 off. So use that CAPSPACE code at helixsleep.com and get yourself an awesome mattress. All right, yeah. So you mentioned the Celtics. Been a rough go of it for them. Now down to 20-19. Still looking good by ESPN's BPI playoff projections to make the playoffs. Their differential is pretty high. I think it's like 3.5, which over the course of a full season, it gets you to be a high 40s, you know, maybe even low 50s win team. I mean, that's basically what the Rockets had last year. But they are 2-6 in their last eight. As we mentioned on the show, they started what I was my preferred big man combination in Olynyk and Amir Johnson. That just did not work very well. They went back to Solinger. They had scraped out a win against the Pacers last night. But yeah, I mean, tell us some of the stuff that you're seeing from them in the stats lately.
So one of the things that I've seen with my eyes in the last little bit is the idea, like just watching them, is that I felt like their offense was bogging down in the end of close games. And so I looked into it, and the answer is sort of. So the thing I found really interesting is that in the last month, they are 21st in offensive rating in clutch situations, but it's still 105.2 per 100 possessions, which is pretty good, you know, in normal situations. It's just that for whatever reason, in the last month, teams are doing well.
So clutch situations, is that the usual?
That's the NBA's definition.
Within 5 points.
Yeah, 5 points, 5 minutes. So within 5 points in the last 5 minutes. And for the season, they're 22nd with a much lower number. So basically, it's kind of like a high variance situation in the last month because some teams have only played a couple of clutch games in that time. And it makes sense just when you think about the creators, especially a lot of that time, they were without Marcus Smart, who was kind of their other guy who could really create offense for himself and others. So they used Evan Turner a little bit. They tried some other things. But it's another situation for them, though, that I think they're so talented and they play hard defense and things like that, where this is not an issue that will cripple them in the regular season, but would be very devastating in the playoffs.
Yeah, I think that that's probably right. And you mentioned that they have the lowest turnover rate in the league for the last month. They are one of the biggest turnover teams as on defense, as the Pacers found out to their detriment last night with that crazy ending to the game where they just got a bunch of steals in a row and basically went on a 14-2 run in the last couple of minutes. So and Boston, I think because of the fact that they're good in the turnover areas, they don't look as good, because really when we watch a game, just sort of our understanding of the zeitgeist of how the game is going basically is, all right, who's making shots, who's not. Like, turnovers almost don't factor into it as much, especially avoiding turnovers on offense. You know, if you could shoot 40% and you never turn the ball over, you can still actually be like an okay offense, because you know, league average is about 13-14% of your possessions get ended in a turnover. So if you can cut that down, you can be a lot more efficient. Now, avoiding turnovers, a lot of those teams that have been really good offenses in the past, you look at maybe like the Hawks before Budenholzer got there, those Blazers teams with Brandon Roy that kind of had a low turnover rate because they ISO'd a lot, they were less effective in the playoffs. I don't really think of the Celtics necessarily as being like that, though.
I don't either. And one encouraging thing you talked about, the turnover rate, is also that they upped their free throw attempt rate, which is something that you want to see as well, because that's another way to get points without scoring, without making buckets in the half court, is to draw fouls. And they've done that. And my big question with them, and this is something I'm not ready on an answer yet, but I've been thinking about as I watch them, is I love Marcus Smart, But I'm trying to figure out, we talked about this a little bit with Zeller yesterday, of where his role is on the next, like, great Celtics team.
Well, you would like it to be the point guard. That's what they drafted him to do. That's what he was so good at Oklahoma State, getting to the rim and finishing. He showed some flashes in summer league of Kraft running the pick and roll. He has not particularly been put in that role for the Celtics. You know how good he is on defense. I mean, in most situations, he can guard 1 through 3 pretty effectively, although you wonder whether he can keep up that intensity level, both on an individual game basis, because he fouls a lot, but also, you know, he's gotten hurt a fair amount in his career as well. And I think that's really been the biggest thing for him, is he really lost the entire first half of last year with that really bad sprained ankle. Then he had this that same issue this year. Well, it wasn't the same issue, but it was another lower leg issue with, what was that? What was his injury? Do you remember? It was something to do with, like, fibula and tibia sprain or plateau
that
or something.
Right. I don't remember for sure.
Yeah. Anyway, it's not a great lower leg injury. And I think he's now kind of starting from square one again. He looked pretty decent at the start of the year. So I think ultimately getting him to be able to play in pick and roll and be at least, you know, an average pick and roll point guard. And he's still pretty young. It's only his second year. Like, cause this whole, all right, we're going to play him off the ball and he's just going to take a bunch of jumpers. Like, he's just, I think it's very unlikely that he's ever going to be efficient enough in just that role. Like, he's a guy who's going to have the ball in his hands, or he's a bench player, basically.
Yeah, and I think you can also strike the balance if you get the right person next to him, which I think you can do, of having him be somebody who's more of maybe an initiator, let's say, in transition, just a force in that way, and then he's a secondary guy in the half court. I think that could be the balance, but it just kind of, it depends a little bit on where he gets offensively. But the nice thing about Smart, why part of the reason I like him so much, is he's such a defensive force that he's worth having out there even if he doesn't reach his offensive ceiling.
Yeah, and he is a good fit defensively with a lot of guys, because he can guard either the point guard or the shooting guard, and then Isaiah Thomas can guard whoever is the least threatening of those two players. Let's get to Brooklyn. 11-28, 2-6 in their last 8. They fired Billy King. They fired Lionel Hollins. You wrote a piece about this for Sporting News yesterday. Your thoughts?
So I think that we've already talked a lot about the mistakes that were made and everything like that. And what I'm intrigued by with this team is that they have a very narrow path moving forward, because they don't have picks. They don't have their own first round pick. They don't have solo control over it for 4 years. I think the only second round pick they have in that time is if the Celtics swap picks, they get the Celtics pick. But at the same time, they have an opportunity, because they're going to have very little bad salary on their books after this year. And they have some market advantages, because they're in a major city that players want to play in, and they're going to have playing time. So I think that what you have to do in these next 3 years is build the asset base. And, you know, if somebody great decides to come, that's awesome. You know, if Al Horford, Kevin Durant decides to come, you deal with that. But just make sure that you're judicious about your space. Kind of the parallel that I've used a little bit the last couple of days is a little bit like what Houston did before they got Dwight Howard, is, you know, roll it over, do your best, and be open to the great opportunity when it comes. But the challenge with that is you have to be patient, and you have to be ready. You have to be just kind of active, but not just irritating other teams, and be in the right place. But I think they can do it.
Maybe so. You kind of wonder about what is really the goal of ownership. Still, Mikhail Burgoff did not sound like he was exactly Mr. Patience in making these moves. Brad Doolittle made a good point that firing the coach and GM together was helpful, because at least you avoid the farce of the new GM coming in and saying, oh, I really want to work with this guy, and then kind of almost hoping he fails and then firing him and getting his own guy in there. I don't think Hollins necessarily, you know, I thought he was getting about what could have been hoped out of this team, but I don't think anyone would say he was doing some unbelievable job either. And Billy King, you know, maybe he was, as Tim Bontemps always likes to say, he was great at managing up. It was his gift and his flaw, because he kind of would just do whatever the ownership and, you know, some of the higher executives wanted him to do. And, you know, maybe they would have been better off with someone who could have pushed back a little bit more and said, all right, we got to extract more value from this deal. But in any event, I think to me, the strategy is, all right, just try and do what you can in 2016 and 2017 free agency, but don't get any contracts that are going to run too long till back when you actually have your draft picks again. I think that what they kind of want to do is be as good as you can maybe for these next couple of years, try to even sign guys to contracts that can be assets, you know, take some, you know, maybe similar to what the Blazers did this year. You take some gambles on younger guys, hope that some of them pay off, and then maybe, you know, 2017 or so, especially when you can trade Brook Lopez, if he's still playing well, trade Lopez, trade Young, just in time for you to start having your draft pick again. You get some more assets there, and then you can begin to rebuild your asset base starting in 2019. But, I mean, no owner wants to hear that, and then, all right, where you sort of start the rebuilding cycle again in 2019 with a little more assets than you normally would to start a rebuild. But no owner wants to hear that, oh, yeah, you know, maybe we could be good again in, like, 2023. But that's sort of the situation they're in now.
Yeah, it's hard because realism here is so negative. But at the same point, that is the way that things are. And so you kind of have to deal with the bet that you made yourself. And what I feel better at for the Nets, like for ownership in that way, is that this isn't like they inherited a bad situation. It was already there. They created this. So it's not one of those like, oh, they sold the team and you were sold a bill of goods or what, anything like that. That's just the way it is.
Charlotte, 18-20, a relatively disastrous 1-7. They had lost 7 straight before waxing the Hawks at home on the first game back from their road trip, with Batum finally being back. And what do you think now about their playoff chances after this stint? I mean, I think they're a good home team. They're going to have more home games now coming up. I think they still have a chance, but they're going to have to play pretty well.
Yeah, because you have the issue with the East where there are so many teams that you have to play better than a series of other ones. It's not just like you have to jump one team, but I think they have the ability and the talent to do it. We saw how much better they played with Batum closer to full strength yesterday, and they're really well coached. They do a lot of things that help them be a good regular season team, like not turning the ball over. They play good transition defense, and those are the types of things that travel well. Those are the types of things that you know, that you can succeed with. And yeah, so it's crazy with their schedule. So they play, this isn't about opponents, this is about locations. In January, they play 17 games, they play 5 home games, 12 away games. And that's tough, but I think this team can handle that and weather that storm better than most if they're close to full strength.
Well, you could say that, but then they had just lost 7 straight. So maybe that, and it's not over yet, but I mean, I think they should be pretty close now to having even home games the rest of the year. I think, though, overall, and I was reminded of this yesterday when he had an unbelievable game against Atlanta, Kemba Walker playing better is one of the big surprises of this season. And I went back and looked at what he's doing better. He's improved his finishing at the rim incredibly well. He used to be one of the worst finishers by percentage in basketball, shooting around 50% or so for his career at the rim. He's at 57% now, which is totally respectable, maybe even good for a point guard, and especially someone his size. He's also shooting 35% on threes, and just his jumper in general, even on long twos, looks a little bit smoother. And this, to me, he certainly has improved. You know, I think he's 24, 25 now, and when you'd expect him to be coming into his prime. But it reminds you that playing with more space, shooting more three-pointers, that's not just about those guys are shooting threes. Threes are an efficient shot. It opens up the rim for guys who are going to drive. Kemba is a smaller guy, with them having no space with Kid Gilchrist, Henderson, Al Jefferson on the floor in past years. Now, all of a sudden, he has way more space. And while he may have gotten better at his actual finishing skill, I think just that the environment is the biggest thing, that it's better for him to get to the rim and score because there is so much more space on the floor.
Because I'm required by law to tie everything back to the Warriors, I think that there's a parallel here that those Clay and Steph did do a lot better, from my eye, now finishing with Draymond on the floor than they did with David Lee under Mark Jackson. And it's because, yeah, there are less players around, especially if it's a power forward. Those are guys who are often good weak side shot blockers who, whether they block the shot or change the shot, just make it harder to finish.
Chicago, 22-15, 5-3. As we talked about, they had that 6-game win streak followed by a 3-game losing streak. They are at Philly tonight, so you would expect that that would that losing streak will be over. A couple of trends for them. The first is that Nikola Mirotic, starting at the three, still is not an effective lineup.
It isn't, and that doesn't surprise you, does it?
No, it was terrible last year. I mean, and it just that's one of those ones where you could say, all right, you know, they haven't played poorly in that lineup. I forget what the exact numbers are, but you know, I think they're like -8 net rating or something like that. The last time Bloggable had a post about it, or maybe it was it was John Schumann a couple of games ago. But it's one of those things where like your Bayesian prior, you know, your prediction of what's going to happen is it's not going to be good because all that he does really is shoot threes. He's not going to drive by guys at the three, guarding threes, although he is not terrible at that. It's more difficult for him than as a four, which is basically what he's played in his entire career up until this point. So there isn't necessarily a reason to think that it will work. And then when it doesn't work, even if it's a small sample, you're a lot more likely to conclude that this is a real thing. Now you could say McDermott has been out injured a little bit. Tony Snell is very hit or miss, although they defend much better with him just subjectively. Still, it goes back to missing Dunleavy. And also, they're just trying to get Bobby Portis more minutes. We'll see whether that continues or not. And then the other thing is the return of Joakim Noah for the Bulls.
Yeah, and so he's back, but he's not all the way back from what I've seen. And, you know, that's fine. I mean, we were talking when he got hurt about the idea of that he might not be back. From what I remember, is that you would have enough time to evaluate before the trade deadline. It looks like now that'll be the case. But I think that you still have the concerns of how they've looked with him since he got back.
Yeah, he had an incident in the game the other day against Washington where he looked to have tweaked it a little bit. It hasn't looked that great finishing around the rim again, but this will be an interesting game for him because Gasol hasn't traveled with the team. He's been nursing some maladies to Philly. It's too bad it's not against a real team because I really would like to see what he looks like starting. Unfortunately, as far as I know, they're probably going to start him with Gibson, which is not a great idea, starting him with Portis or Mirotic. But, you know, Gibson is a starter, and so, you know, you can't take him out of the starting lineup because it's considered a demotion. So they're going to play a bad lineup for, you know, at least 12 minutes a game now. And then off the bench, I mean, I still would like to see more of Mirotic and Gibson as well, which is not something that we saw. I felt like they should have closed against Washington that way, especially because Washington was just absolutely killing them with the small lineup and some of the threes. So it's Chicago is looking a lot more like what I thought they would under Hoiberg, where the offense would be a lot better. They've now scored over 100 points. In something like 10 straight games, like the most that they ever have going back to like the 90, like 92 or something, although they've lost a bunch of these games because they've been giving up a ton of points. So they've looked a little bit more like I thought they would under Hoiberg after they were the exact opposite, great defense, terrible offense throughout the first couple months of the year.
Another team that I think is looking more like what we expected now that they're, in this case, it's now that they're healthy, is Cleveland Cavaliers, 27-9, 6-0 in their last, since the last time we did this. And we can talk about, we talked about the game they played against Dallas, which was awesome, but the Texas trip continues tonight with one of the biggest games of the regular season so far against San Antonio.
Yeah, I have amazing timing. I'm flying to Chicago tonight, and then I'm during this game, and then I'm flying back during the Golden State-Cleveland game.
So Monday. Anybody who has hopes of a dunked-on breakdown of this game will be sorely disappointed.
If it's awesome, I might actually be willing to go on and do like 20 minutes on it or something, but after I watch it on tape. But I think the way that they match up with the Spurs is very interesting. I think the Spurs are almost a perfect matchup for the Spurs, maybe even more than the Warriors match up with them, because they've got Kawhi to guard LeBron, probably does the best job of just about anybody. Maybe you could say Jimmy Butler or Paul George would be the other two, and then Danny Green can guard Kyrie, and they have a pretty good hiding place for Parker with JR, who has been hot lately. You can shoot the ball over Parker a little bit, but or Amon Shumpert, and Shumpert is probably going to be needed to guard Tony Parker on the other end the way that he's been playing. And then they have Tim Duncan is great when he can guard guys who aren't huge threats with, and Tristan Thompson and Mozgov are that. They're not going to step out and shoot the ball, you know, make him really guard in space a ton in pick and roll. And then they also have really one of the best defensive rebounding rates of all time to try and shut off that Cavs offensive rebounding. I like the way that they match up with them defensively, which, you know, not a surprise since they're one of the best defenses ever.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that their defensive personnel is really well suited, and also the Spurs have a bench that I think matches up really well against Cleveland's bench. They move the ball well. They have a lot of smart players, and so I think that's another way that they can push an advantage. And yeah, I agree with you that the Spurs probably do match up better with the Cavs than the Warriors do.
I also think that when the Spurs have the ball, they can cause some problems for Cleveland. LeBron, really the only guy on the whole team who's qualified to guard Kawhi. If they put Shumpert on him or JR, Kawhi is just going to back down and score on that guy. That helps. Tony Parker in pick and roll, the way that he's been playing, is a pretty good matchup against Kyrie. LaMarcus Aldridge against Kevin Love, I think that that's probably advantage Spurs as well. So, you know, Tim Duncan's not necessarily going to post up or anything. But, yeah, I think that the Spurs have the ability to look pretty good against Cleveland. We'll see how that actually ends up happening tonight. And since this isn't posting until tonight, maybe I'll look like a complete moron after the game has actually ended.
Something I want to see, maybe not in this game, but just eventually, is I think that the Cavs would massively struggle with Kawhi at the 4, LaMarcus at the 5, because I just cannot think of a combination of players that Cleveland can use to make that, to defend that lineup, and really, they don't sacrifice too much defensively as long as you still, because you still have the hiding place for Tony Parker.
Maybe so. I would be shocked if the Spurs went to that. I don't think that they really have very much at all. That would actually be something interesting to look up. Maybe we can get to that when we talk more about the Spurs, because we are kind of talking more Spurs than Cavs at this point. And the Cavs, having won 6 in a row, have looked very good doing it. Kyrie being back, they're now like pretty unstoppable offensively. They have some ridiculous, like over 120 offensive rating right now with Kyrie on the floor. And this team has just finally become the juggernaut that we saw down the end of last year and believed that they could be as soon as Kevin Love signed there.
Yeah, they have so much offense.
Or was traded there.
Right? I mean, think about how useful J.R. Smith can be as legitimately the fourth option on a team like this. I mean, it's incredible to think about what all the other guys can do, and then you just sitting there and you're like, oh, and the guy that we're going to lay off is really good at hitting open shots and is eternally confident.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the way he's been playing, he's had over 20 points on very good efficiency in some of these games. That was an underrated part of why they struggled so badly in the finals, that he just couldn't hit a shot. And I think the Warriors got lucky a little bit in that respect, that those Cleveland role players couldn't hit threes. Now, the goal was to kind of shut those guys off, so they were getting tough shots. But JR has hit tough shots in his career. And if he keeps shooting like this, Kyrie playing like he is, it's going to be a really, really tough to stop offense. And it may not matter that their defense is good, but maybe not great.
Yeah, I think my theory with Cleveland for a long time has been that their defense only has to be good enough, and I think it's already there.
Detroit, 21-17, 4-2. You noted that they are 25th in field goal percentage. They were 24th last year, and that doesn't surprise me a ton. Like, who's an efficient offensive player on this team? Maybe Ilyasova is the only guy that you could point to who has a history of being efficient. Even Drummond, just due to his free throws, has been below the league average in true shooting percentage most of his career.
And the challenge for them, they do have cap space, but just they've been good. You know, it's not like they're going to get this super awesome draft pick or anything like that. Is how do they have players that can get better. They have spots that are, you know, that are open, quote unquote. Like, as much as I like a guy like Stanley Johnson, you know, if you get somebody better, you can move him to a different role. And two guard, of course, KCP's done well, but if somebody else comes in, it's going to be hard for them to really ratchet that up. I think their defense is going to be good, but my kind of pet theory with them is that they're just kind of, maybe the next Memphis, is that they'll be good, you know, they'll be relevant, they'll be dangerous, but that they won't ever be strong enough offensively to be that, to be like a real, let's say, a championship contender.
The next Memphis would be the second best team in the East for most of these last few years, and right, probably this year as well. I mean, that was a team that, you know, topped out at 57 wins and gave some of the best teams in the West all that they could handle. That would be wonderful. I don't know that I necessarily see even that high of a ceiling for them, because those Memphis teams were top five defenses back in the day. But, you know, I think it's interesting if you are going to look at it now. All right, what does this team really need? I think Brandon Jennings is providing a little bit. I would have said, you know, some kind of a gunner off the bench, another scorer. He's been, you know, he hasn't looked like himself explosively getting to the rim, but just as a guy who can create a shot and make it every once in a while and run a pick and roll decently, he's been a nice upgrade. He's been playing, you know, the backup point guard minutes pretty much immediately since he came back. Steve Blake now mercifully excised from the rotation. What else do you think that this team could use? I mean, I guess like a true wing scorer, you know, Marcus Morris is like sort of a facsimile of that, but a guy who could actually run a secondary pick and roll on the wing would be my number one on the wish list for them.
Yeah, it would be that. And then I would love to have another guy who was just, even if they couldn't create, obviously I think that's what you want the most, but if you could have somebody who you just feel like kind of a poor man's Klay Thompson, in the way that the other team just feels they can't leave them open. You know, just, even if they're limited as a shooter, that just opens up space for everybody else, because now you can help off of various guys and you can exploit some of their weaknesses. And I think that would create a little bit more of a seam for Reggie. But of course, if you could do it, if you could get a secondary ball handler type guy, even a guy like Danilo Gallinari, like you can see just what the kind of things he could do. He would be a nice little kind of wrinkle for them in that way.
You know, I think that, and I was kind of thinking about who they have and what they need. Anthony Tolliver is a guy who's never really excited anyone, but he actually has gotten to the point now with his shooting where he's a real threat. He actually has come off some screens in some sets for them. They set like a nice, they did like a nice horn set where then I think he was at the left elbow, and then they ran a pick and roll with him, and then immediately the other guy on the horn at the right elbow set a flare screen for him and got him open for a three-pointer. I mean, when you remember him, how limited he was when he first started his career, and it was, you know, back when he was getting dunked on by Amari Stoudemire for the Warriors, it's pretty remarkable what he's been able to make himself into. And also worth remembering that the Pistons got him from the Suns totally for free last year.
Yeah, they did. They've done that a few times from the Suns.
I mean, what are your memories of him as a player when he first broke into the league with the Warriors? You were going to those games.
I was covering them. Yeah, I mean, he was a guy who he tried hard. He didn't do a lot of stupid things on the court, and he was one of those players who was you could tell he always worked hard because everybody on the team really liked him, and he was well spoken and all that at a time when a lot of the Warriors weren't. You know, that was a very different team than their current team, and I remember him as one of those people who I thought was going to be kind of on the fringes of the league for a while, because I thought about the guys who had kind of stuck in that kind of a role, and he kind of fit the personality type and the skill type. I'd never expected a shot to come this way. But at the same time, you know, with kind of the way that you can work on your game with somebody like him, I think that it makes sense. I just never saw it coming.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he was sort of struggling to shoot 33% back in those days on like just wide open standstill shots where he had an hour to get it off. I mean, and now that he's become this level of shooter, a really intelligent guy who will communicate, who can switch a fair amount as well. You know, not a ton of athleticism, but still a very valuable player. You know, he closes games for this Pistons team. He's making like $2 million a year. Let's get to the Pacers now.
Yeah, Pacers are 22-17, 4-5 since the last time we did this. And I just feel like they're just as untapped potential. The idea, I talked about it at the beginning of the season, they've done better. It's just, I think they need more guys because they're going big a lot, mostly because they just don't have the small guys, and that's not helped by Rodney Stuckey being out a few weeks with it's a sprain, right?
Yeah, a sprain and bone bruise in his right foot. Mark Spears just tweeted that out earlier today. He's going to, it's one of those things where he's out 2 weeks and then he's going to be reevaluated. you recall last year, you know, he got a minimum contract from the Pacers in his age 28 season, got a 3-year, $21 million contract now starting at 29 to come back. And he shot 39% on threes in what was a pretty low volume last year. Had never been a good three-point shooter before that. And lo and behold, this year he's right back, even worse than his career averages at 20%. Just has not been a great shooter. And it's a good reminder that, you know, you like to think that, because it's great. You want to believe that a guy has improved, right? And that's why he's shooting better from three-point range. And it makes sense, right? Like, that's something that players work on. They get older, you think, all right, he's going to add this skill. But you have to remember that to really be sure from a statistical standpoint that a guy has improved as a three-point shooter, you need about 750 attempts from three. And that's basically, like, nobody's going to shoot that many in a season. Maybe Steph Curry might get there someday, but you really need sort of 2 or 3 years of, you know, a regular player shooting threes to believe that this is a new skill level that they have, you know, at least if you're just only watching games and basing it on that. You have to kind of also evaluate based on practice, what you see in warm-ups and shooting drills and stuff like that to add to your evaluation, because that sample size with him shooting 39% last year was nowhere near enough to say, all right, this guy's figured it out from three-point range.
Do you have a feel yet for where you think they're going to end up in the East? Like, I don't see them in that kind of 2-3 range. I think of them making the playoffs, but maybe in like 4-7, something around there. Just my feel on where they are relative to all these other teams.
They are second in defense right now, 15th in offense. You know, despite all the changes, very kind of similar to how they have been in past years. Now, the year that they were average offense, they also had the number one defense by a mile throughout most of the year. That year that they got the number one seed in the East, they're not nearly at that level. Defensively now, you know, they've underperformed. They have the point differential of a 24-15 team right now. And I don't think that now that Paul George has come back to earth a little bit, I don't think there's anybody that you look at is totally just unsustainably killing it. You could even say that Monte Ellis overall has got to be a little bit better than he's been so far. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if I had to guess 4th through 6th seed in the East, I don't think they're going to be struggling to make it, but getting into the top tier seems pretty unlikely. Oh, wait, I mean, they're a lock to be the 2nd seed in the East. Never mind.
Nice. Speaking of another team that was looking a lot, better, and we'll kind of have to see where they go with it. Miami, they lost yesterday. They're 22-17, 4-4. They lost without Dragic. I don't read too much into that, except that there were some little rumblings and grumblings about players with injuries. But,
well, all right, so yeah, don't just allude to that. What were they?
So I'm trying to remember who wrote the piece. It was Jason Leiser of the Palm Beach Post. After they lost, they got whooped by the Clippers last night. Whiteside played a little bit. He did not play against the Warriors. And I'm sure people are going to take the first part of Chris Bosh's quote about Whiteside and not talk about the second.
Let's set the scene here a little bit, sure. Just with what the injuries have been for him. He's been struggling with a sore knee, came back for a couple of games, then missed a couple of games again. He did not play in that Warriors game, which was somewhat amusing to a lot of Warriors backers, because you'll remember that Twitter spat that he got into with Draymond Green about how, like, small lineups wouldn't work against him, and then, you know, he didn't play. Came back against the Clippers. It makes a lot of sense that he is being cautious, considering he has made zero money in his career basically so far. He's been a minimum guy and is set to make it, you know, at least an 8-figure salary, if not a lot more than that, coming up. So I understand why he's being cautious, but you know, you hear some rumblings out of Miami that he's sort of not a Heat guy. I think that Brian Rindhorst said that on a podcast the other day, and now there are these Bosh comments that you were alluding to.
So Chris Bosh, very nice guy, and I'm going to do the whole thing. I'm going to give context, and I talk fast, so it won't take that long. He said he's not injured. He's hurt, because they asked about him playing through an injury. There's a difference. It's a 90s quote, isn't it? Hey, man, nobody's going to play a violin for you. We're all banged up. That's part of the game. I think he played well, but we needed more. You could say the same about me. You got to get more from me. You got to get more from Dwayne Wade. Got to get more from everybody.
All right. Yeah, I mean, and if this were just a guy who'd been on the Heat for 5 years, you know, you wouldn't necessarily raise your eyebrows with that, but maybe you would with this. But one thing about Whiteside, and this is just sort of more of a statistical curiosity, because I think he's a good player who has some potential, you know, and Zach Lowe was saying don't put too much into the fact that they've struggled defensively more. I shouldn't say struggled, but they've been worse defensively with him on the floor. He now has a 10.4% two-point block rate, and that is almost double the second guy, which is Anthony Davis at 5.7. That is the highest all-time of anyone not named Manute Bol or Hamed Haddadi among players who have played more than 30 games in a season.
I love that Manute Bol got a reference on this podcast. It was the first time, I believe.
Yeah, but I mean, and those guys, Haddadi, Bol, those guys are like not even real players. You know, like Whiteside is a real player who plays 30 minutes a game and, you know, is good enough at the other aspects of basketball other than shot blocking that he's not just sort of like a specialist. So pretty remarkable accomplishment, although it is worth noting that because three-pointers are excluded from that, that it is easier because a higher percentage of twos come around the rim now than they used to, because it used to be a lot of the jumpers that are threes used to be twos now, and so then they would go into the denominator of that stat. Now that doesn't happen anymore. So it is easier to block shots now than it was, at least in that statistic. But still, pretty remarkable, because generally I think like less shots are blocked now than they used to be. And the league leader in blocks is usually much lower than they used to be back in, you know, Hakeem Olajuwon's day.
Yeah, and one other thing not Whiteside related that I thought was interesting about this team is that Dwayne Wade is struggling in isolations. It's one of those things that, you know, you kind of see when a guy can get a little bit older. He's 0.62 points per possession in terms of guys with the, I can't remember if I did the filter at 50 or I think it was about 50 possessions. He's sixth from the bottom, and he could get better at that. He's such a crafty guy, but that hurts. You know, that's another way that their offense can be limited. And something that I saw when we covered their game on Monday is I just love the chemistry between Dragic and Bosch. I think those guys could do a lot together if you give them the time.
Yeah, and Wade and Whiteside, Bosch and Whiteside don't have, or I'm sorry, Dragic and Whiteside don't have a ton of chemistry. Wade and Whiteside seem to, he's assisted Whiteside much more than Dragic has. And we talked about that on previous programs, how Dragic kind of has more experience driving to the rim and then playing with more of a shooting big man. And what you said about the isolations, remember that kind of the line between an isolation and post-up is somewhat nebulous. And Wade, a lot of times when he has a situation where maybe earlier in his career he would have tried to go one-on-one and Euro step or something like that, instead he'll kind of put his back to the basket and try to bully his way into the lane. So he realizes that facing up, he doesn't necessarily have the quickness that he once did, and his advantage is more with his back to the basket. Let's get to Milwaukee, 16-25, although a slightly encouraging 4-4 since we last talked about them. What have you to say about them?
Well, I'm thrilled for them that they were not the worst defensive rebounding team in the last month. They're only second to last, which is kind of incredible when you think about just that they are a team that's long. They're not a team with particular defensive rebounding aptitude. But the big concern for me with them is that since December 1st, we talked a lot about how they, you know, they had a rough start to the year and all that. And so you take that out of the equation. December 1st, they're sixth from the bottom in net rating. This was before they lost, I believe it was before they lost to the Wizards. And they were, so six from the bottom means they're about 2 points per 100 below Portland, who, you know, Portland's been, they've been pretty good, but, you know, they're still not a playoff team. And that kind of gives you, to me, an idea of why they're not going to be a playoff team this year.
Yeah, I mean, they're not, if they're in the West, they would actually, like, not be that far out of it. But just when you look at their overall fundamentals, they definitely are. But that is not due to Chris Middleton, who struggled early on in the year. We almost kind of forgot about him as one of the key players on this team, despite the fact that he signed that big contract in the offseason. But he's actually now up to 17 points a game, shooting 44% on threes, just about the same on twos, so that's not that great, but a 57 true shooting percentage, doing very well in offensive RPM from the shooting guard position. But defensively, you know, it's funny. He was talked about as, you know, a great 3-and-D guy. His defensive RPM was really good last year. And at the Sloan Conference, Gerald Morey just kind of cryptically made a comment when he was brought up that, no, I actually think of him as more of an offensive player. And the numbers from an RPM standpoint have shown that, that he actually is like quite into the negative in defensive RPM this year, as their whole team obviously has fallen off. And, you know, he was a guy I didn't get a chance to watch a ton of last year until the playoffs, and he got lit up pretty badly actually trying to guard Jimmy Butler one-on-one. They've gone with Giannis as the guy on most of those big wing threats lately. So I think that this idea maybe that he, you know, he's not a bad defender by any means, but that he is like a stopper and he's going to shoot threes, like we may have to reevaluate that conception of him.
But to me, that's why you have Giannis. You know, you have a guy who has that kind of defensive potential, who can do that. I mean, he's not all the way there yet, but you do that with Giannis. And what I like about Middleton in that way is I think he's capable enough of being the second guy, you know, that he can handle. He's versatile enough. I think he can handle enough threes. You know, you're not going to put him on Kevin Durant, but you're not going to have him on Kevin Durant in the first place. You know, if he's guarding the second best swingman that the other team has, I think he can do well enough there. The challenge for them, I think, is just getting the offense and everything else that you need from the other three spots. I think that those two guys together can work. Of course, I'm somebody who thinks that Giannis at the 4 and Giannis at the 5 offensively is interesting, but then you're asking for something very different as a complementary player to those two together.
Yeah, and the problem is if you're going to play Giannis even at the 4, his defensive rebounding is probably inadequate, not to mention the 5. And then if Jabari Parker is in there too, he's really has been a very disappointing defensive rebounder. You had a stat that I thought was interesting. Doesn't concern me, but Jabari Parker only 0.59 points per possession in isolation, just 41 possessions. I actually had gone through and looked at the film of his isolation numbers a couple of weeks ago just because I was surprised that they were so low. I think basically the problem is just that his jumper is still pretty broke right now coming back from the ACL. As I've mentioned it before, he's kind of halfway between a set shot and a jump shot right now. I hope that that will come around because he was a pretty darn good shooter at Duke, and going back to his high school days, a very versatile jump shooter. So I think that once he gets to the point where he is making those jumpers facing up, that then he's going to be pretty much unguardable because he's such a quick first step kind of ripping it through. I mean, he had this one play yesterday against against the Wizards, where he just caught the ball on a guy like Jared Dudley, the sort of person who's going to be guarding him a lot of the time, just caught the ball at the elbow and was just gone and had to just get fouled at the rim before Dudley could even react. It was, you know, a great rip-through move by him, and his quickness is great in those areas. It's just too bad that it doesn't really apply on the defensive end. Let's get to New York now.
New York, one piece of news that you might not know because it happened while we were recording is Carmelo Anthony. I believe he moved into the third front court spot on the East for the most recent round of All-Star voting. The Knicks are 20-21, 5-3 since the last time we did this. And while you and I have talked about kind of how the All-Star game doesn't matter as much except for the crazy Rose Rule stuff with stuff like Anthony Davis, I was thinking about it, this is a small non-Knicks thing, that it would be kind of representative of the new era of the NBA if the jump ball in this year's All-Star game was Kevin Durant versus LeBron James.
Yeah, that's true, right? Because Draymond might be in the front court, Kobe. Yeah, that's and we talked about it when we did those awards, that really the smalls have just been way better than the bigs have this year, and that maybe is representative of that, although obviously it's the fan vote. You had some good stats here, though, I think, on kind of what they're doing defensively. They've been really good in forcing misses, but still not unbelievable, you know, in the other aspects of defense and overall.
Yeah, so they forced the least turnovers in the last month. This was before the Nets game, but I think that's still probably pretty close to true. 11.3% of opponents' offensive possessions.
And let's take these one at a time. That seems like something, it's a month, but who on this team is ever going to get a steal?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like maybe Porzingis might be like their best, or maybe someone like Galloway would be the only other guy you would think of. I actually don't know what his steal rate is, but he just, watching him seems like he might get some steals. But yeah, I mean, there's really, you know, they play a very conservative style with Lopez dropping back. Carmelo, never been a guy who gets a lot of steals. Aaron Aflalo, same thing. I mean, Calderon, you know, who is a guy who's ever going to get his hands on balls? So, yeah, forcing turnovers, and they don't pressure up enough to kind of force turnovers even that aren't steals. So, yeah, I think that that is very likely to continue throughout the year. What else you got?
One that I think is less likely to continue, in the last month they were second worst in the East behind the Milwaukee Bucks in defensive rebounding. They gave up a 27.6% offensive rebound rate to their opponents. That's real bad.
Yeah, it is. It's not real bad, but it's not good. But I actually think that that will continue because the statistics, they've gone a lot more now with Porzingis as center on the second unit. They've been taking him out early, bringing him back to play center, taking him out again, and then bringing him back and playing him in three stints. And I like that idea a lot. He's got to get some more experience at center. They can use the help scoring on that second unit when Carmelo is out of the game. You know, they haven't been playing guys like O'Quinn and Seraphin nearly as much. But the problem is that Porzingis, when he's not playing alongside Lopez, really is not an adequate defensive rebounder at this point for a center just due to his lack of heft. And, you know, they're playing kind of Lance Thomas, Derek Williams, like hybrid power forwards next to him in those situations off the bench. So I do think that whenever Robin Lopez isn't in the game and if you're not going with a pure center, that they are going to continue to struggle in that. You know, I'm not sure whether you disagree or not, but that's kind of what I've seen so far.
Yeah, without when they're playing them kind of staggered, I think that will be a problem, especially because they don't have power forwards that are particularly adept at that, you know, other than those two guys. And then the last stat, it's a kind of a progression thing. So you talked about how the Knicks for the season, they're still top five in opponent effective field goal percentage, which is quite good, of course. They're 7th since December 1st, and they're 15th in the last month. So you're kind of that. While of course it could be that this part is non-reflective, to me it just kind of tells the pattern of, okay, that was unsustainable. Maybe 15th is a little bit far, but if they fall a little bit, then that takes out like kind of the if you want to call it the foundation of their defense not being terrible.
Yeah, and they've been, you know, I think 18th or something in defense, 15th in offense. Fantastic improvement, by the way,
for
this Knicks team. To be 20-21 is remarkable considering some of the talent. What they've been able to get out of Porzingis has been pretty impressive. Frankly, I think that they've used him extremely well, have not overtaxed him, allowed him to play to his strengths. I think that I wouldn't say the future is incredibly bright there because they don't have their draft pick this year either, but you have to be pleased with what's been going on. If you're a Knicks fan, part of that surprise has been Derek Williams. He had a great preseason. Then, you know, we kind of laughed. Oh, yeah. You know, he had a good first couple of games. Then it was almost out of the rotation. And it's like, oh, yeah. Ha ha. Like, you know, anyone who was fooled by this was wrong. But now he's actually back to having a really nice stretch over his last 10 games. And he's been getting out in transition a ton. But really what's been fueling it is that he's 30 of 38 at the rim. Taking 46% of his shots from there in the last 10 games, you know, playing a lot again with that second unit where there's more space on the floor with Porzingis at center. I think that's what's been enabling him to get to the rim more. And he's always shot a very high percentage there. He's a great dunker. He shoots 69% at the rim over the last two seasons. But he's increased his usage, gotten more efficient. So playing more kind of at the four this year next to guys who can shoot like Thomas and Porzingis, whether you want to say that he's the four or Thomas is. So it's been impressive that what they've been able to get out of him. And if he can keep this up, then maybe he will actually opt out of that $5 million for next year. The problem is he's still going to struggle a little bit defensively, but overall a very pleasant surprise.
Yeah, and this makes sense as an overall niche for him, being kind of an active part of a second unit, running the floor in transition, you know, doing a little bit in the half court, still being shaky defensively because I don't think there was a way to really fix that. And I'm happy for him because that it's kind of, to me, it's a story of, yeah, maybe he was overdrafted to go second, in my opinion, as a Wildcat. You might be a little bit disappointed in that. But I think that a guy with his talent, there's always a place for him in the league as long as he tries, and he most certainly does. So I think that it's a nice thing to see, and yeah, I still think that the contract is a little bit too big, but I'm happy that he's found a role that makes sense for his ability.
All right, before we move on to the next team, let's pause for a brief word from our sponsors. Orlando, 20-18, but a rough 2-5 since we last checked in on them. And it's looking like the Channing Frye, Nikola Vucevic combination, which had been very effective so far this year, starting, maybe the hourglass is starting to run out on that now.
Yeah, who would have thought that a front court of Frye and Vucevic would struggle defensively if you gave a larger sample size? Like last season.
But it's, although Frye, as has been noted by a few people, including Dan when he was on the other day, was injured for a lot of last year coming back from that MCL injury. So I think he's better this year. But, yeah, it is these sort of smoke and mirrors that they've been going with some of these veterans, maybe not working as well in this recent stretch. They've been going more to the Harris and Gordon front court, which I think they need to figure out whether those guys can play together. Though now, Aaron Gordon has a sprained ankle, so he's actually going to miss some time, which is too bad now that they've been going in that direction. And then who knows, once he comes back, you know, Scott Skiles, could have completely changed the rotation. So I don't know. I still think that this team, I've said this before, kind of coming back to earth a little bit. They do get Elfrid Payton back after a 4-game absence from a sprained ankle that had really dogged him for even before that. Hopefully he will now be 100%. We'll see whether Oladipo goes back to the bench. He'd been starting in Payton's absence. They've had their best stretches this year with Payton starting and Oladipo off the bench. So we'll see. Maybe that will help them get back on track.
And I think that what will be the lingering story with Nikola Vucevic, who's a good player, I'm not saying he's not, is can the offensive prowess overpower, whatever you want to say, the defensive flaws that he brings that are really hard to overcome. And with the Frye Vucevic combo early in the year, they were for the whole season, they're scoring 108 points per 100 possessions. You know, you can be pretty bad defensively and still survive that. They were better than that when doing pretty well. Now that's fallen to 102. And the defensive part, I think 101, which is where they were for the season, is kind of unsustainable. But you have to be so good offensively to justify that, because even if you have good perimeter talent, it's just hard. It's just hard to succeed defensively with that combination of players, in my opinion.
I agree with you, and we've talked about Vucevic before. If he could just get to the foul line, I think he could be a really valuable player. But he just, for whatever reason, that's just not part of his game. Even though he has a big body and he has a pretty high usage, you would hope that he could get fouled. But somehow, every time he goes up inside, it's a hook shot, it's left hand. You know, he doesn't really seem to have any power moves. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with your left hand, but, you know, if he would just kind of duck his shoulder into guys a little bit more, you know, maybe he could get to the foul line and be a little bit more efficient. Let's get to Philly. 4-36, a sterling 2-5 in their last seven. They hired Mike D'Antoni on December 18th, I believe. They then traded for Ish Smith on Christmas Eve, overpaid for him. But since Smith has come in, since D'Antoni has come in, both Noel and Okafor are playing much better offensively. Okafor, in particular, in his last six games has shot over 60% in all but one game, and in that game he shot 56%.
Who'd have thought that getting a point guard who's a capable distributor would help big men get reliable offense?
Who'd have thought that you would rely on the construction? Who'd have thought to discuss a team?
I do like that, don't I? But, yeah, I think that...
That's right. Well, it's fortunate for me because I have zero verbal tics I could ever be made fun of.
Yeah. I think that what's exciting about the Sixers is that we're getting a better chance to evaluate their talent. And, yeah, we can lament that they didn't have this earlier, and that they've looked like an actual basketball team. I was somebody who said that I thought they were less bad than the Lakers even before this stretch, and I think right now they're already better than that. And we'll see where they turn out in terms of record. I mean, they have half the Lakers wins right now, so it might be hard for them to catch it, which in some ways is kind of the perfect storm for them, is that they can have reason for optimism but still have the most ping pong balls.
Yeah, I think a lot of it, too, is just they wanted to avoid the ignominy of setting the record, which is 9-73. already owned by the 72-73 Sixers. Former NBA TV host Fred Carter was on that team. That's the only guy that I can recall who played for them. But I think they're a pretty good bet now, 4-36, to not set that record. They always seem to play better late in the year anyway. A lot of other teams that'll start kind of going into development mode, it should be easier for them. These are young guys who are going to improve over the course of a season, probably not get injured as much either. Smith has really helped them. So just the way they've been playing since then, I think they are, as long as they keep it up, they're not going to be really in much danger of setting that record any longer.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you. I there's, of course, always the possibility, but I wouldn't consider it a likelihood right now.
What do you think of Okafor as a guy in D'Antoni's system?
Well, I mean, I have more faith in him as a passer, I think, than he's shown at least recently.
Yeah, he was good at that at Duke. That was part of the selling point for him coming out in the draft.
And D'Antoni has, you know, he's used defensively limited big men before. I mean, it's not like Amari Stoudemire. While he's certainly more athletic in that sense than Jahlil, I think that you can still do it. So, I mean, I don't think he's a perfect fit, but I think he can work.
I think he can, too. He actually, even going back to his Duke days, his high school days, he's pretty good when he gets out in transition. Now, it's a question of him running the floor every time, but he has always had a very nice points per possession in transition. He's got soft hands, can catch the ball, finish with those huge hands out in transition with like kind of soft plays, avoid the charge. So there's that aspect of it. I think for the same reason, he could be pretty good in pick and roll with, especially, and he's another guy too, who, you know, is kind of ground bound, and when the help defense comes over, he's not going to finish over another help defender. But if there's more space on the floor and he just has his own guy to deal with, when it's kind of a little bit more controlled situation, he knows where the guy who's guarding him is. He's got enough moves to get his shot off and score very efficiently, as he has been of late. And you remember too, Amari Stoudemire, not only in Phoenix, but then in New York even more, had, until they brought in Carmelo, essentially had his best years, averaging like 26 a game under D'Antoni. And while Okafor is not a guy who's as explosive as Stoudemire is, he has been very effective catching the ball at the elbow, taking a couple of dribbles with his spin moves or drives, and then, you know, doing some pivots to lose guys once he picks up his dribble near the rim. So I do think that he can be very effective offensively. Now, is he going to be a good enough defensive player to where you can play a shooter at the four? Because remember, most fours who can shoot probably aren't going to defend very well. You know, I think of the Ryan Anderson archetype, or you're going to go with someone who, you know, is maybe more of a wing. And unless it's Sean Marion and there aren't, or Kawhi Leonard or something, or Draymond Green, there aren't a lot of those guys floating around. Can he anchor a successful defense when you don't have another good defensive player next to him? That would be kind of my bigger question. But I think offensively, he can fit very well in a D'Antoni system.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. And they have a lot of resources to try to find that Kawhi, that kind of guy, if that's their evaluation. That, you know, maybe Ingram's that guy. Who knows?
The Toronto Raptors, 24-15, 5-2 in their last seven. Absolutely destined to be the second seed in the East.
There we go.
And that is because Kyle Lowry has been awesome. Still, he's keeping it up, and we're now at the halfway point. So maybe the fears that he was going to wear down like he did last year are becoming a little bit less likely now.
He has been the best guard in the East so far this year. Would you agree?
Yeah, who's the competition? Jimmy Butler?
Butler. I mean, some people might say his teammate, DeMar DeRozan, but I think Lowry's been objectively better.
John Wall had like a really good December, but a bad November, and now he's kind of been hurt and dropped off a little bit. Yeah, I think that's probably right. I'd probably rather have Kyle Lowry than Jimmy Butler. Maybe not. I don't know. Jimmy Butler is – I always still, like, maybe it's just my prejudice. I always just kind of wonder, like, how he's doing it. I do think that Butler's – offensive game, although he has had some high assist games lately, and this is a little bit of a digression, but you know, we're allowed to do that. It's our podcast. I don't think of him as a guy who really makes his teammates a lot better. And you know, that's a phrase that's very much overused, But, and it, that doesn't just mean assists. It means the influence that you have, the gravity that you provide, how much the defense has to account for you, how well you move the ball, the spacing that you provide when you're on the perimeter, how well you cut, all those things kind of go together. And I think that Lowry, just due to his shooting ability, the fact that you really should not go under him on the pick and roll most of the time, and then the fact that when he's off the ball with DeRozan, he can get open threes as well. I think that he is just so much more of a versatile offense player. And then he's also actually been one of the best defensively at point guard at times as well. His numbers on that end are very good. So, I think, I would agree. I think Kyle Lowry has been a little bit better than Jimmy Butler so far this year.
Have you liked what you've seen so far? Continuing, it was a story we've talked about the whole year with the Lowry-Joseph combination still sometimes closing games.
Yeah, and that really has helped keep them afloat with Damari Carroll being injured so much this year. They play Joseph at shooting guard, essentially. Those lineups, I think, are like plus 13 points per 100 possessions in over 500 minutes. I mean, still not an unbelievable sample size, but you can say at least that those lines have been effective so far. You don't know for sure whether they will be going forward. And Joseph is a guy who can guard most shooting guards pretty well, unless, and can even switch, is strong enough to just fight, stop guys from getting the ball in the post. You're impressed by what he does, just the little things like denying the ball inbounds, which he takes back to his Spurs days, to just slow the other team down after a made field goal. I think that is a good combination. And then obviously you're going to play DeRozan at the three. The only problem is just that combination, if you're playing against Jimmy Butler, LeBron James, Paul George, three teams that they're probably going to match up with, Carmelo Anthony as well, then it gets a little dicier because, and you go back to their same perpetual problem of not having anyone to guard big wings. But when they're not playing against a team like that, that lineup really works well.
I would be so interested to see a Raptors-Celtics series for a lot of reasons, but I think that it'd be fun because their strengths and weaknesses are just kind of, it's an interesting mishmash. And also there's the Amir Johnson part of it, but I don't think that's a big deal. But I think it'd be fun. And DeRozan, I still am not all the way on with him like some people are. I feel Ian Levy wrote a great piece about him for, I believe it was for Hardwood Paroxysm. It might have actually been for the Sporting News. I have to remember.
It might have actually been for the Cauldron too. It could have been.
He writes everywhere.
Omnipotent or not omnipotent.
Omnipresent.
Thank you. Yeah. Gosh.
But so DeRozan, when I looked at it, this was a couple days ago. He was second in points per possession as the pick and roll ball handler. We can get into the classification issues. We talk about it all the time. But of high usage guys, being second in that, I believe he was second behind Stephen Curry, is pretty impressive.
Yeah, it is. And just he's gotten a lot more crap now. Zach Lowe wrote about this a little bit too. He's pretty decent at getting guys on his back now, finishing, drawing fouls as well. I mean, he's one of those guys that takes so many bad mid-rangers that guys almost aren't used to defending those shots without fouling anymore. So he can get guys in the air, which you probably don't want to jump at that because he doesn't shoot an amazing percentage on those shots. I think that just... he's a guy who's made himself some money. We talked about that on the podcast with Dan on Sunday. And, going right into his prime, that's what you should expect.
Yeah. Anything else on the Raptors?
Now let's move on to Washington.
So the Wizards are in this weird place. They're 18-19, 4-4 since the last time we did this, where I still keep seeing enough where I'm not willing to write them off, but I completely understand why others are less optimistic.
Yeah, and Nene has returned now. It was looking pretty dire. They had said that he hadn't even tested out his calf, but maybe that was subterfuge because he returned shortly thereafter. And he's looked great since he's been back. He looks explosive. I mean, he's still a couple times a game, he'll break out one of these drives that's just like really violent and get to the rim. Defensively, he's been excellent. He took a couple of great charges in that Milwaukee game. On the year, he's only played 267 minutes, but they are plus 8.3 points per 100 in those minutes. And we had talked about how they're just getting killed whenever Gortat was out of the game because they don't have another backup center. There's nobody on this team who can protect the rim other than Gortat and Nene. So, the hope is that Nene is not going to break down But I really think that with him back and then Beal also returning, he played a little bit the other night as well against Milwaukee, that maybe they can try and make one more run here and get back into it. Because I do think that this is a good team, and we haven't seen them all together trying to play this small ball style. Jared Dudley, really, even back when Nene was healthy earlier in the year, he was coming off that back surgery. He's now kind of fully formed. They're getting something out of Kelly Oubre. Allen Anderson might be back soon. So they actually now finally on this team have enough bodies, although Otto Porter injured his hip. He may be out for a little bit. I only had to leave the game the other day. But if they can finally get everyone back, I do want to still see what this team is capable, because I think they have a lot of potential, because, you know, I picked them to be I picked him to be number first. One in the East.
Yeah, I mean, Otto Porter is the equivalent of the designated survivor during the State of the Union, because the Wizards can't have everybody on the court together, so they always have to have at least one guy gone. And Porter's a disappointing one because he's had a fun season. But one thing I wanted to bring up, you talked about Nene. Of course, you took a smaller sample size with that they've been plus 8.2 with Nene in 277 minutes. I'm going to make it an even smaller sample size to 128. But those 128 minutes are the minutes that Nene has played with John Wall, which has mostly been during Gortat's absence. In that time, the Wizards are plus 14.2, which is...
Yeah, I don't think Gortat and Nene have played a single minute together this year. I haven't heard of that, and I haven't seen it at all. I could be wrong, but I think that was their plan, was to not play them together.
Yeah, and the other important part of that is that, so they're plus 14.2 with a defensive rating of exactly 100. And so I think that might be, of course, it's a small sample size, you're dealing with a lot, but there's a lot to like about that. And one of the big questions with them, which the singular presence of Nene will not help, but the eventual combination of Gortat and Nene not together, but just having a center all times, is this season the Wizards are rebounding 4.5% less of their own misses than last year. So they had an offensive rebound rate of 24.9% last year. They're at 20.4% right now. That's a lot of just possessions that are left on the table for a team that is doing so much worse defensively.
Yeah, and that's just because they've got their four men standing at the three-point line all the time.
Yeah.
And you do make the note that you'd think they'd be getting back on defense, they'd be playing better defensively because they're crashing the boards less often. And it could just be that they're crashing the boards just as often as they were. They just don't have as many good offensive rebounders in the game as well. That could be another aspect of this. Yeah, I mean, that's really one of the lower offensive rebounding rates in the league. Maybe having a pure center in there will help. I guess the other note I have on them, too, is that Gortat was in the hospital. So they said in the broadcast that he was watching the game from the hospital yesterday due to a knee infection. Fortunately, it is not apparently a staph infection, so there's some hope that he will be back relatively soon, but it sounds like he's going to miss at least a few games.
Wow, that was actually maybe the fastest we've done this.
Yeah, maybe that's true. Maybe we're just not doing a good enough job preparing anymore.
But, well, the listeners will tell us if we did a good enough job.
Yeah, and actually, one thing I do want the listener feedback on is I think we're going to start doing some deep dives on individual teams, getting some guests on, you know, much like we did with the team previews, check in on kind of where these teams are. And so I want to take some suggestions on which teams you guys are most interested in. That we should try to have a guest on for and get a little listener feedback to determine the direction of the show. I think I want to start doing maybe one of those a week for the next couple of weeks to check in on some of these teams. So hit us up on Twitter, Nate Duncan NBA, Danny LaRue, to give us an idea of what direction you want us to go with that. Anything to talk about before we go?
Yeah, I haven't finished editing it yet, but by the time this is out, my podcast with Tim Bontemps will be out, the writer now for the New York Post, or previously for the New York Post, currently for the Washington Post, and I wanted to have him on to talk about the whole Nets boondoggle, which we talked about a little bit on this podcast. We ended up talking a lot about LeBron, which was fun. My podcast is very different. I don't mean that in any sort of negative or positive way. It's just different. And it's a really fun conversation, and it's about an hour and a half. So save it for when you have a very large lawn to mow.
Yeah. And Bontemps is, one of the best guys on the Nets as well, even though he's now moved on to national coverage with the Post. So yeah, definitely recommend listening to that one. And I will probably listen to that as I'm on my way to the airport, which I need to do right now. So thanks so much for listening. If you want to support the show, use that cap space code at Helix Sleep that would be a great way to do it. That is a fantastic product. I'm really can't say enough how glad I am to have them on board as sponsors. It's always nice to have a product that you are actually using and really enjoy that you get to talk about. You don't experience less cognitive dissonance that way. So that's good for me and also for you and for the show. If you go and use that CastSpace code with them, also an iTunes review or rating, very much appreciated in helping us get more sponsors and keep this little endeavor going, which we enjoy doing so much. So Danny, thanks so much as always. We'll talk to you all next time.